The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, well, we've got four great topics for the 4th of July show here. Hope everybody's ready for a great holiday weekend that's about to kick off. We're going to start by talking a little bit about the hurdles of turning the new health care bill into reality. We've got two good guests for that, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the challenges facing General David Petraeus, who was confirmed yesterday as the new top war commander in Afghanistan. We'll have some folks from the State Department and retired military officials with us for that. Then we've got a legal battle involving a professor from Kenya with AIDS who's seeking to permanently work and live here in the United States. And we'll wrap up with a little look at intellectual property law, talking about a crucial decision made by the Supreme Court this week in that area. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with the health care reform bill. Joining us, John Jonas, one of the leading health care policy folks in Washington, D.C., and somebody who's a regular on the show, as well as Julie Black, who works with John and is also one of the blog mistresses, I think that's the right term to use, for CapitalThinkingHealthcare.com, the place to go for all your information on what's happening in the healthcare world. So welcome, everybody. And John, let's start with you and talk a little bit about some of these well-known reforms that are included in the Affordable Care Act, including a lot of things that aren't going to go into effect for years, but a lot of things that perhaps have gone into effect here on July 1st. Can you talk a little bit about the areas of reform that have been implemented or are about to in the next few months?
Sure. As we know, the healthcare reform system is sort of like a giant oil tanker. Maybe that's a bad example these days. Maybe we should use ocean liner. But turning around a system of that size and moving it in another direction is a process that's really going to spread out over a 5 and in some cases almost a 10-year period. So there's a long, long process of kind of retooling our healthcare system, and Congress will probably reengage in that process over the coming years. But there are a fair number of things that are really going into effect over the short term as well. Some of them important, very important to different segments of the population out there. Obviously, one that's folks have heard a fair amount about is the ability to keep young people on a parents' insurance up through age 26. The administration has asked insurance companies to make that effective as soon as possible. Legally, it's effective 6 months after enactment, so we're in that process right now of expanded coverage on the parents' plan for those 26 and under. The Act also sought to slowly close what's called the donut hole, which is the co-insurance portion of Medicare Part D for senior citizens. And one of the first things they did was to provide a rebate of $250 to Medicare beneficiaries in 2010. And so those checks actually will begin to go out relatively soon. There was an effort to increase research in areas of new drugs for new diseases, and they did this through a $1 billion therapeutic tax credit slash grant program for smaller or sort of startup drug research firms. So if you're a small firm, have less than 250 employees, you can apply to HHS, and you can get a very substantial tax credit, or if you're not making money, which you need to cash in a tax credit, you can actually get a grant to work on drug breakthroughs.
Sounds like that might be one of those things that ends up being oversubscribed, that they'll have, you know, more than $1 billion in demand.
Yep. I think this will be, you know, this really is, Kevin, in nature, like a competitive grant program. So while it's administered by the Treasury Department, since it's a tax provision, HHS will really be reviewing the grant applications, and folks will be submitting grant applications, really within the next month or so. So it's that's really kind of up and running. Something that there's been a lot of interest in is sort of a pool of money that the administration is handing out under the Act to the states to pay for high-risk individuals. Those are usually people with current conditions, usually can't get insurance. They should be a lot easier for them as all these reforms kick in, but the high-risk pools are being set up currently. Money is really just starting to flow from the federal government to the states, and that will provide some relief. Something that's been in the news over the last 24 hours, if you follow this stuff closely, is the new web portal that's just been open. And actually, this is one of these things where it shows spending a little bit of money can probably have a big bang for the buck. And this is a website that HHS is running that you can go to. It can look at up to 3 billion individual permutations and come up with sort of the best option for you. So you go to the website, you put in, it's not...
So say if I was looking for hair plugs, for example, as
exactly,
a you covered
could
activity.
Say, I'm 25 years old, I have this sort of this level of income, I have this and this condition, maybe one requiring hair plugs. What kind of coverage could I get? Obviously, you wouldn't be able to get government coverage. It might, under other circumstances, push people towards Medicaid or Medicare, or it'll go through private insurance and says, here are the plans which would provide you with coverage. And as the portal matures, they plan to put pricing data in there, so you'd actually be able to say, here are the private health insurance plans that cover this kind of condition, and here's what they charge for premium, so you could actually do some cost comparison.
Well, let's shift to Julie here for a minute. I would mostly be interested, John, in finding that plan that would cover liposuction and hair plugs, sort of standard benefits.
Might be a small list, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, 3 billion permutations, it sounds like there'd be one out there for me.
Let's hope so.
Julie, one of the goals of healthcare reform is really focused on the quality of care, and John spent a lot of time talking about the deadlines of various things, and we're starting to sort of see HHS, turn the machinery on all this, but what steps are they taking to implement all the quality control provisions that were sort of central to the reform bill?
Sure. So the healthcare reform requires the system to improve quality in a number of ways, and one of those is through payment reform. And what we'll expect to see is a move toward pay-for-performance, and this will require that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services adopt quality metrics by which to determine how particular healthcare sectors are improving outcomes and improving quality. So the National Quality Forum, whose endorsement of measures is the gold standard for measurement of quality of care, requested public and member comments on its plan to establish a partnership for applying measures to improve quality. And ACA requires the secretary to assign an entity with the responsibility to convene multi-stakeholders to provide input on the selection of measures. And given the NQF standard and reputation in this arena, we do expect Secretary Sebelius to assign NQF with these duties. Once the organization is crowned with having these duties, we do expect that the plan which it sought comments on will be implemented to establish the partnership. And what the NQF outlined in terms of the duties of the partnership is that they would provide input from these multi-stakeholder groups on areas such as Hospital Compare, the Physician Quality Reporting Initiative, the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program, and a number of measures that would be used in demonstrations such as the medical home, the accountable care organizations, and bundled payments. So the work of the partnership will expect to be done over the course of the next few years, which will be key.
Now, Julie, one more question on process, and then I want to come back to big picture with John. But this, the bill actually authorizes a myriad of boards and commissions. It's one of the things a lot of people complained about, was sort of a new alphabet soup of those being created. Talk to me a little bit about how your average everyday person can get involved with those, or even how medical professionals with a great deal of interest can get involved in specific commissions that have been set up as part of the bill.
Sure. The bill, the statute actually requires that a number of healthcare professionals and other stakeholders, healthcare experts, for example, be included and serve on a number of these newly authorized entities. So, for example, the president is required to appoint 25 individuals who are not serving in the federal government to the advisory group to the National Prevention, Health Promotion, and Public Health Council. And the advisory group is charged with making recommendations to the council regarding lifestyle-based chronic disease prevention and management, integration of healthcare practices, and health promotion. Another one authorized in the bill is that the president is required to appoint 15 people to serve on the Class Independence Advisory Council, and their task is to advise the secretary on the administration of the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Act program. And through this program, the government is intending to establish a long-term care insurance option for individuals. So probably one of the lesser-known components of the bill, but one that probably a number of people will be able to benefit from.
Now, Jonas, you're a lobbyist. I don't think there's any chance that you'll be allowed to be appointed to one of these advisory boards or commissions. But I do want to come back and ask you sort of a big-picture question, and that is, I see conflicting data points about whether or not a public perception has changed now that the bill has become law. We're about 60, 90 days into its existence. Do you see public perception changing, and how does that impact, the speed with which these things are rolled out and how the administration handles some of all this?
As they say, when you're not sure of the answer, good question. I think a couple of different things have happened. One, I think the public temperature on healthcare reform has come down sort of substantially. I think some of those people who are in favor of it are a little less enthusiastic. Some of those who are opposed to it are less enthusiastic in their opposition. But I think people are really waiting to see what the results of the act really are. And there's been a slight shift in favor of the healthcare reform bill. But I think the real test is going to be, can people start to see perceptible changes and advantages in the healthcare system?
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Great. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big
trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball,
off the glass,
football,
come on,
golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Well, if you follow the news closely, you know that yesterday the United States Senate, in almost record time, confirmed the appointment of General David Petraeus to be the top military commander for American forces in Afghanistan. General Petraeus is the gentleman who so successfully led the counterinsurgency tactics in Iraq over the last couple of years and is now replacing General McChrystal in theater in Afghanistan. Our guests for this segment, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's a former Afghanistan-Pakistan analyst at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence Research, and our good friend Colonel John Garrett, who's been with us before. A man, I could tell you where he's been and what he's done, but then he'd have to kill us all. I think that's how the old slogan goes, right, Colonel?
Oh, go on.
But he does have some experience in these matters, as they like to say. Well, let's start generally. And Dr. Weinbaum, let me ask you. Well, first, let me start with you, Colonel Garrett. Tell me about the effects of what you think the McChrystal incident has on the war in Afghanistan for the warfighters themselves.
I think it'll probably, at the end of the day, have very little effect. I mean, everybody was in sort of this bit of shock. But particularly the ones over there on the pointy end of the spear, they've got day-to-day things to go on and to worry about. And I think that as far as that goes, and you'll see it on the news and see it in the papers, they're just pretty much continuing apace.
Very good. And Dr. Weinbaum, sort of the flip side, what do you think the Afghanistan people think about General being called home over a magazine article and sort of summarily dismissed and quickly replaced with another big name in the American military?
Well, I don't know that the people as such are tuned into that. Obviously, the political leadership in Kabul, Karzai and so on, they were reported, and I think we have every reason to believe, had a very good relationship with General McChrystal. In fact, there was some criticism of that perhaps General McChrystal was too ready to agree to whatever they wanted. But the hope here is that with General Petraeus coming in, who brings a lot of panache with him because of his previous experience and his general popular support here in this country, that he's going to be in a better position, perhaps, in dealing with Hamid Karzai, not necessarily trying to dictate to him because that doesn't work, but at least getting him to understand our position better and perhaps getting more give on his part in a number of areas.
Doctor, I know there was a report, I think, in the paper yesterday or today talking about Congress is a little bit upset with corruption in Afghanistan, and in a subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee, they had voted to withhold a few billion dollars in foreign aid to the country, sort of in protest, concern over how the money they've already gotten is being spent. Does that send the right or the wrong message to the Afghanistan leadership team?
Well, I think it does send the right message. I don't doubt that we will release that because it's such a major part of our COIN strategy that we move ahead also with supporting this government in non-military ways. It is helpful. It's not going to really, I'm afraid, get him to make the kinds of reforms. Things have gone too far as that's concerned. And anyway, what he has cleverly done, Hamid Karzai, is in a way to change the agenda. He's got everybody talking about peace, reconciliation, and has taken, really distracted us from what had been our mantra that you've got to reform, that you've got to create more credibility with the Afghan people. He's changed the agenda on us.
Let me come back to you, Colonel Garrett. You've got a new general on the ground. What do you think Petraeus is likely to do different from what McChrystal was implementing strategy-wise when he lands in Afghanistan?
Okay, first, let me just make a comment on your last, if I might. I agree with Dr. Weinbaum. That's the right signal. You know, one of the tenets of the mission for the force there in this counterinsurgency operation campaign is to facilitate improvements in governance, and socioeconomic development. So there are non-war, if you will, kinds of things that need to be done, and that's all part and part of our policy there. So I think that's the right thing to do. In terms of changes, I think that probably we won't. After all, the policy is the president's policy. It's the policy of the National Command Authority in the United States of America. So, you know, Petraeus won't make changes there unless he recommends back through his chain of command. However, I think the big difference that we'll see, once General Petraeus gets on the ground and makes his initial assessment of the threat of the ongoing operations and what the situation is, I think we'll see in the difference in the execution of the policy, not necessarily the words or the character of it, but that's what Petraeus is a master at, and I believe that that's what allowed him to prevail in Iraq, was his bringing together of all the relevant parties toward a common goal.
And, Colonel, I know we've heard a lot of complaints about the rules of engagement General McChrystal had put in place. A lot of media coverage of incidents where troops felt like they couldn't respond effectively or take prophylactic measures to prevent future attacks, and that maybe that was undermining troop morale and their impact. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you think General Petraeus might do to fix that problem?
I think he'll review it. I think he'll look at it. I think if there are any changes that are made, it probably won't be in the content of the rules of engagement, but probably in the communication of them. I mean, this is a sensitive issue, and after, you know, leading Marines in combat in three different campaigns around the world, nobody's more sensitive to that than I am. But I've talked to veterans. I've talked to folks who've come back across the spectrum, and I really haven't found anybody that I've talked to with personal experience who felt that they were hampered. The idea here is that this is a counterinsurgency operation. Part of that is protecting the people. So if you destroy the people with our own weapons, then you're failing in the initial tenet of your policy there.
Very good. Well, you know, the big picture question, here we have a supplemental appropriations bill pending in the Congress right now that, you know, Defense Secretary Gates says needs to pass by this July 4th recess before the Defense Department has to start shuffling things around. And there's going to be a huge debate in both chambers in the coming days over whether or not we're going to be able to meet our deadline the President has set to start withdrawing troops by July of 2011. So, Dr. Weinbaum, let me come back to you and ask, is that a realistic deadline still? And if so, what has to happen to see it start to get implemented a year from now?
Well, it is a deadline. It's out there. But what we've seen, of course, is that the president and others have been, to some extent, walking away from it. I don't think that it was ever what it has been perceived to be here and certainly in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that is that we were picking up and leaving at that point. It was never that, but that's the way it was perceived, and we have to live with that. But I do think that if we're going to sustain the military part of this effectively very much longer, we've got to redefine why we're there. We've got to get off the business of it being all about al-Qaeda. That's just not a defensible position. What is defensible are the regional and beyond consequences if we fail there. And I don't believe that's been conveyed either here or among our coalition partners in Europe, for example. And unless we do so, I think this debate that's starting up again is inevitably going to tie the hands of people who would want to sustain our operation there.
Now, Colonel Garrett, in getting rid of General McChrystal and bringing in David Petraeus, the most popular general perhaps in the military forces right now, and someone people actually thought had an outside chance of being a Republican candidate for president in a couple years, it seems like maybe President Obama has put himself in a corner. He can't very well get rid of Petraeus after all he's done. Is Petraeus bulletproof?
Well, he probably is, but I think that Petraeus won't let it get that far. Petraeus has respect for the office of president, for the National Command Authority, and again, his forte, his core value, his start point, if you will, is people working together. So I think before that ever got to that point, he would make sure that it didn't happen from his side.
Very good. And Doctor, do you have any thoughts on that too, from perhaps the perspective of the folks there on the ground that the general has to work with in the government?
Well, I think that the colonel is much better positioned than I am to comment on that. I agree entirely that it's going to be his ability to get people to work together, and the focus right now is on whether he can get the ambassador and Mr. Holbrooke as well on that. And I think that there's every reason to believe that will happen. It seems as if now they have decided that they are not going to make any other major changes. I'm pretty confident that we're going to see improvement in that direction. Whether that adds up to the kind of momentum that we need in the Kandahar operation or not, we'll just have to wait and see.
Excellent. Well, we have been joined by two fantastic guests here talking about the situation on Afghanistan as it continues to evolve. We'll be back in just a moment with more here on Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoy Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoy Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, you know, on this show, we like to spotlight individual outstanding efforts in the pro bono area to help people in need. And we've got one of those cases we want to talk about today. Joining us, two young rising litigators from Washington, D.C., Kristen Johnson and Yami Hurtado, to talk about a situation involving the complexities of immigration law with the intersection of policy regarding HIV and AIDS. So, ladies, welcome to the show. And, Kristen, let me start with you. Why don't you give us a little bit of background about this case?
Thank you, Kevin. This case came to us last year through the Whitman Walker AIDS Clinic in Washington, D.C., and it involved a woman who was from Kenya and who had formerly tried applying for permanent residence through her employer, which was a university where she had received a doctorate in history, but she had gone through the process all the way to the very end only to find out that she was barred from becoming a permanent resident in the United States because she was diagnosed with HIV back in 2002. So she ended up having to apply for asylum, and we decided to pick up her case and help her out last year and take on her asylum claim. And we took the case. We actually were lucky enough to get a year-long continuance from the immigration judge, and in the meantime, some of the policy changes regarding the ban on HIV-positive individuals was lifted.
Oh, terrific. Well, Yami, let's turn to you and tell us a little bit about what this HIV, AIDS, travel and immigration ban, where did it come from, and what were its limitations?
Well, the ban originated in 1986 when Health and Human Services and the CDC promulgated regulations to add HIV and AIDS to the list of excludable diseases. There was a category for contagious diseases that could affect the public. Congress interceded and actually amended the Immigration Act to specifically mandate HIV be included on this list in 1987. The ban, essentially, not only did it prevent people from becoming permanent residents, but it also placed restrictions on traveling to the United States, even for vacation or business purposes, if an individual is HIV positive. They could be denied entry into the country. So the ban was in effect until 2008 when Congress amended the statute, but for that entire period of time, individuals could be sent home or denied adjustment, like our particular client, just on the basis of the disease. It was very contentious, and it's had a very tumultuous history up and down, various repeal efforts. The scientific community in particular was very opposed to the ban, and it led to quite a few boycotts of the United States. For instance, this coming year will be the first year that a large international conference dealing with AIDS research will actually occur in the United States since 1990. So it's
Interesting. Well, let me come back to you, Kristen, and talk a little bit more about the intricacies of the case. I know oftentimes, especially in immigration matters, you really do have to have a couple of things break for you in order to get the determination that you want. What have had to happen here for the client to get permanent residence?
Well, he could basically, the ban had to go. Number one, the ban had to go. That was a complete bar to her getting permanent residence, with the caveat that if she received, not necessarily a caveat, if she received asylum status in the United States, she would be able to stay here, but she wouldn't be able to apply for her green card. So no matter what, she wouldn't have been able to get her permanent residence, also known as her green card, as long as that ban was in place. So the ban had to be lifted. It was actually lifted, as Yami said, in 2008, but it didn't go into effect. The lifting of the ban did not go into effect until January 4th of this year. That was the first thing that had to happen. There were also some problems along the way, though, because having been denied permanent residence back in 2006, the way that our immigration laws are set up, there was a period of time where our client did not have any employment authorization, because if you apply for asylum, you have to wait for 6 months before you can obtain authorization to work lawfully in the United States. So she lost her job, and losing her job was pretty devastating for her. It was accompanied with the loss of medical insurance, which, of course, was assisting with payment for her HIV medications, and was kind of a big disaster for her personally. So she ended up leaving that particular university and going and finding a job, but it took several years for her to find another job, employers being wary of her asylum claim and not having permanent work authorization in the United States. She finally found another job teaching history, and that enabled her to renew her adjustment of status based on the employment visa that was already approved for her from her former employer. And I know immigration laws are complex. I'm trying to break it down a little bit. But one more thing had to happen for her to get her permanent residence. And that was an important decision that came out also earlier this year from the Board of Immigration Appeals called the Matter of Netto. And what Matter of Netto said was that if someone has had a application for adjustment of status pending for a considerable amount of time and it hasn't been approved yet and they change their employers, they may port their visa from the first employer to the second employer so long as the second job is substantially similar to the first job. And so having gotten another job and having originally applied for adjustment of status, and that particular application had pended for well over a year, so it meant the time requirement for porting a visa, we were able to request that the court recognize her new employer as basically her sponsor employer for her green card.
And talk to me a little bit about the politics and the policy of the ban going away, and maybe who some of the central players in that are at immigration and in Congress.
Well, the latest repeal effort began in 2007 when Representative Lee of California introduced the non-discrimination in Immigration and Travel Act in December of 2007. The same measure was introduced by Senators Kerry, Durbin, and in the Senate. And eventually those provisions were incorporated into the Tom Lantos Global Leadership on HIV/AIDS bill, the big PEPFAR bill that passed in 2008. Unlike the previous situations, like in 93 and 90 when these issues were before Congress, 97% upvote on this issue. That was the vote on the regulations and all the comments that were submitted. The votes were pretty clear on the floor of both the House and the Senate. They won by resounding margins. And actually, the debate really almost largely ignored the issue of this of the ban. Comments were far more geared towards other provisions of the statute than lifting the ban itself. By the time this came to a vote, I think there was a pretty uniform consensus that this was bad policy, it was based on bad science, and it had to go. And then HHS took up the handle immediately and worked on revising the regulations. So,
which still in the world of administrative law took a year and a half.
Well, that's pretty fast, I'm sure, in the administrative law world. Well, tell me this. What kind of precedent does this case set in the immigration world?
Well, interestingly, it doesn't set precedent itself because it's just an immigration judge's decision. But what it does show us is that the ability for judges to, one, go back and look at applications that have been filed and were denied based on the ban can be done. And I think that is a message that really can be sent to anyone who's had problems in the past. I know while HHS was passing the final regulation to lift the ban, Immigration Services did place basically a hold on adjudication of all the pending cases for adjustment of status where there was an HIV-positive individual involved. But people who were denied before that can now come back, and I think it shows that the courts are ready, willing, and able to entertain requests for decisions in their favor.
And what does this mean for your client's actual claim and sort of her life going forward?
It's basically a ticket to freedom for her. She's been working very hard. She came to the United States in 1994, earned her doctorate, raised a daughter by herself, and put her daughter through law school. And she basically thought she was going to end up being sent back to her country of origin and not able to access the medications that she needed. This opens up the door for her to continue pursuing her career here, kind of living the American dream like a lot of people want to do, working her way up the ladder. She now has permanent employment authorization because of her green card, so she can go seeking jobs, and that should make it much easier for her to seek jobs. And she can basically live her life here, free from the anxiety that she's been suffering for essentially 3.5 years since her original denial.
Well, that's got to be a terrific feeling for you guys. Talk to me a little bit about the personal satisfaction of getting to work on a case like this and coming to this result.
Well, for me, this was actually very gratifying because I'd actually had quite a few people that I'd known over the years subject to this ban and facing a very similar situation to that faced by our client. So it was extremely gratifying to know that we were able to help this woman overcome the vestiges of a lot of ignorance in the late 80s, honestly, regarding the disease and regarding just people who were infected with it. So in that regard, it was very gratifying personally for me.
And for me, it really does lift my heart that we are able to spend time and we're supported so well in pro bono efforts and in spending time helping someone essentially secure their livelihood in the United States. She was really injured by our system, and it's been wonderful to have support to help overcome that. And personally, I find it incredibly gratifying. You don't every day get to have someone call you up and say thank you for saving their lives, but that's the message we received from our client after we were able to successfully get her permanent residence.
Interesting. Well, this is a fascinating story. I take my hat off to both of you ladies for, one, finding the time inside a busy legal career to focus on things like this and to pursue them to the happy conclusion for this history professor and her family. I think it's a great result, and it shows the important role lawyers can play in pro bono activities. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about the Supreme Court and intellectual property law.
Thanks, Kevin.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street,
to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. The final week of the Supreme Court session this week, which means lots of big decisions come out here at the end before they go off on summer vacation. We have with us a leading intellectual property lawyer from Northern Virginia in to talk with us about the Bilski versus Kappos case, a very significant decision handed down by the Supreme Court, a court that perhaps doesn't normally get involved a whole lot in intellectual property. Scott Chambers is our guest. Scott, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about what the Bilski case was all about.
Thank you, Kevin. The Bilski case addressed what was patent eligible. What could you get a patent on? It didn't go to necessarily whether or not something was patentable as much as was this technology patent eligible. And generally speaking, patents are available for any process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter. But you know, the word process is a really broad term, and it can include mental thoughts or laws of nature. And this particular situation was one that dealt with business methods.
Interesting. And this was sort of a bifurcated decision by the Supreme Court. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, All of the justices came down and said that this was something that a patent shouldn't be granted on. Five of the justices went on to say that business methods are patent eligible, that you can get a patent on a business method, which is very important for the financial industry. But it also indicated that a majority of the court took a very broad view of patent-eligible subject matter. And by and large, I would say that most importantly, the opinion really offered no encouragement for those who would like to restrict the scope of patentable subject matter, such as those who decided that gene patents were not patentable. Instead, the court found and mentioned technologies from the information age that they should receive protection.
Interesting. And what's so important about this case to people in the industry?
Well, I would say that it's most important because it dealt with what types of technology the U.S. gives patents for. It's when you look at an invention, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, is this patent eligible? And is it the subject matter that somebody would give you a patent for? And, of course, a patent is the right to exclude all others from making, using, and selling. And so if you're going to give somebody that monopoly-like right, you've got to be very sure that Congress has authorized that type of right to be passed out. In this particular case, once you get past the patent-eligible question, then you have to decide whether or not it's actually patentable, which goes to looking at has somebody done this before, or would it be obvious to one who's skilled in that area of technology?
Interesting. So obviously software and the software industry, they have a big interest here, and also maybe some other technologies?
Yes. Actually, the majority opinion implies that patent protection remains available to software processes. You know, software, you could think of it as an algorithm or a mathematical statement, which might put it into the realm of not being patentable. But instead, the Supreme Court didn't seem to suggest that it wasn't patentable. For instance, the majority viewed that there were several amicus briefs that they were viewing favorably that argue that the machiner transformation test, which was which some courts had been using to constrict the patent eligible subject matter, that the majority found that test was too narrow, and it also found that patent eligible subject matter could expand to include things that did not satisfy that test.
And Scott, we hear a lot about in the Supreme Court conservatives versus liberals on IP things. Are there two discernible blocks? Are there Luddites versus progressives in terms of technology and intellectual property? How does this sort of typically break down?
It doesn't seem to break down like that. This is something that. You might find a liberal who believes that there's broad patentable protection, or you might find a conservative that found that there was narrow patentable subject matter. Generally, since patents are fundamentally important to business, you might take a little more conservative view since you are protecting property. However, what was I found particularly interesting was the fact that one of the justices that joined the majority opinion, Justice Scalia, refused to join the section of the majority opinion that said or that suggested that times change and that the statute has to be interpreted in terms of that changing technology. It would suggest that perhaps certain types of technology would suggest that certain types of law would be changeable, and he didn't join that part. But by and large, there doesn't seem to be any particular party associated with either protecting more with patents or protecting less with patents.
And where do you see things going from here in light of this decision?
Well, in fact, it probably leaves things a bit confused. What had been going on is that the Federal Circuit, that appeals court that addresses patent matters, that they had come up with a test, the machine or transformation test, and they said that if you did not satisfy this machine or transformation test, you were not eligible for any kind of a patent. And that would have been a nice bright line rule, but the problem is that you don't know what types of technology will come up in the future, and the Supreme Court found or determined that it was probably better to not make a bright line rule like that, and that it would be up to the courts below them to come up with other tests. And so really, on one level, the Supreme Court said that patentable subject matter was broader than what the Federal Circuit had suggested, which is very good for patent law. What they didn't do was help out by saying what the standard would be. And without that kind of standard, I expect that there will be a good deal more litigation on the subject, as not only in the agency, that is not only in the Patent and Trademark Office, but also in the district courts.
And so more work for the intellectual property lawyers of the world to...
Yes. I look forward to that, but at the same time, it does put a burden on clients because they have to have a good understanding of the changes in the law and a good understanding of which way the law is going in order to determine where they're going to put their investment dollars and where they're going to try to achieve protection.
And Scott, real fast, I know the intellectual property cases don't come to the Supreme Court a lot. We'll talk more about that. We'll have you back another time. We're going to wrap up here, folks. Everybody have a great 4th of July weekend, and we'll see you next Thursday for more Capital Thinking.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.